you know, Mars is very similar to Earth in a lot of ways. And so people are curious about whether life could have evolved there, or, you know, maybe it started here because a meteorite carried it from Mars, things like that. So one of the questions that people have about Mars in general is was it habitable at some point? And volcanoes play into habitability a lot. They produce gases that can make atmospheres nice for living creatures, and they can melt ice to make water flow, which is also useful for most life as we know it.
Hi everyone, welcome to The Vandal Theory, a podcast about science and research at the University of Idaho. I'm Lee Cooper, editor and science writer here at U of I, and I'll be your host for today. And I am joined by my wonderful co-host. Hi, Danae.
Hi, Lee. My name is Danae Lenz, and I'm the external communications coordinator at U of I.
How you doing today?
Pretty awesome. The weather was supposed to be crappy, but it's really nice.
Excellent. All right, so today we're going to talk about geology. On Earth, and on Mars, and even online. A question to kick us off. Did you ever nerd out about geology as a kid?
Well, first of all, I just want to know, I'm very curious about the online part of geology. You have piqued my interest. But yes, I loved rocks as a kid. Still loved rocks. Just collecting rocks. Like, I'm that kid in adult that's just out there on the beach, like, looking through all of the rocks. Not even interested in the seashells, really. Just the rocks.
Just the rocks.
And it wasn't like super, super deep beyond just, I love rocks, you know? But yeah, rocks are great. But I will say, and I wouldn't call this nerding out exactly, but the earliest point in my life when I was moved, let's say, by geology was I went with my family. I was around 12 years old, went to Yellowstone National Park, and we were camping there, and there's an amphitheater. And on the amphitheater, there's this video playing about how right now you're sitting in the middle of a volcano that is definitely going to go off again one day. And that's how I developed a deep-seated fear of volcanoes. I wouldn't say it was like the number one cause of my anxiety, but it was definitely anxiety-inducing because I grew up in a place where if the volcano went, I would be gone immediately. And it still scares me as an adult, to be honest. I just am good at compartmentalizing.
And the Rangers can add another check to their tally of traumatized children watching volcano videos. I gotta say, I don't know that I liked rocks. I picked up rocks, had a rock collection as a kid just because I loved exploring outdoors. But I think kind of a love of an excitement of geology happened by accident. I had taken, you know, kind of physics 101 in college and hated it because math is not quite my strong suit. And I really didn't want to take physics 2. And so instead I took, and I can't remember exactly what it was called, but it was like physics of planets or physics of the Earth or something like that. And it turned out to be the physics of how like glaciers work and how tectonic plates work and erosion and all of these like physical geology. That's what it was called. And it was fascinating. And I loved every bit of it. And ever since have been fascinated by the subject.
Gotta love when you take a random college class and you end up just absolutely adoring it.
Oh, it was so much fun. Well, today, like I said, we're going to dive into geology, and our professor, Erica Rader, is in the Department of Earth and Spatial Sciences. And with her, we're going to discuss how scientists are studying the geology of Mars, how astronauts will need to navigate when they get to the moon, and even how to go on a geology field trip online. All right, ready to dive in?
I'm so ready. This sounds exciting.
Erica, hello. How are you doing today? Welcome to The Vandal Theory.
Hi, Lee Cooper. Thank you for inviting me on The Vandal Theory.
It's wonderful to have you on. I've been meaning to do this for so long, and I'm so excited to talk about volcanoes.
Me too. Weird.
So can you introduce yourself to everybody real quick?
Sure. Hi, I'm Erica Rader. I am a I'm technically still an assistant professor for another month, but I just got notification that I'm going to be tenured, so I will be an associate professor in the Department of Earth and Spatial Sciences, and I study volcanoes.
Excellent. Well, congratulations.
Thanks.
All right. So we are going to talk about volcanoes. How did you get into volcanoes? Is this a childhood love?
It was a childhood fear. There's a whole series of National Geographic videos back in the day, and we would get to go to the video rental store, you know, on Fridays and pick out movies. And for some reason, I was always drawn to the like scary volcano ones of the National Geographic videos. So I definitely was aware of them, but I wouldn't say that I was obsessed or anything. You know, by the time I was in college, I was able to take a class on volcanoes and I had so many questions. And the professor of the class was like, okay, why don't we get you doing research because you have a lot of questions. And it's clearly something that I've been interested in since then.
Well, I do remember being freaked out by Dante's Peak. So
yeah,
I vibe with you on that one.
Very realistic movie.
Yes. Yes. Gives me the creeps every time I go through Wallace.
It's such a beautiful little town. But you know, the volcano was CG'd into the background of Wallace. So I always look at the spot, though, when I drive by. It's like, oh, there's the gap where there should be a CG volcano.
Thank you. Now my drive can be much more stress-free. All right. So you not only study volcanoes here on Earth, but you also have been drawn to volcanoes not on Earth. How do you and other geologists study volcanoes on other planets like Mars?
Yeah, it's a funny question because the way that I study volcanoes on Earth is very much just walking all over them and picking up pieces of them and looking at them. So that's pretty hard to do on other planets. It takes a lot of money and a lot of logistics, and you're splitting that astronaut or rover's time with a whole bunch of other scientists who have a bunch of different questions.
Even tenure doesn't get you quite
no,
there.
No, boy, the things you need to get time, astronaut time. But what most people do when they're studying planetary geology is they use remote sensing techniques. So they use the way that light bounces off of the surface of planets to figure out their chemistry and their composition and the geomorphology of the sort of the geologic history of how that surface has changed over time. They'll look at patterns that you see and try to find places on Earth where we also see those patterns. And that's called analog work. And then there's also a big part of it that is called numerical modeling or other kinds of computer modeling. And you use kind of laws of physics to figure out, well, what should happen if the gravity is this much? And what should happen if the atmospheric pressure is this much? And you run a whole bunch of models and you see what makes sense and what doesn't make sense. And then sometimes if you're lucky, then you can find places on these surfaces of other planets that have, for example, the size of the cone is the right size for what your model produced. So that means it's theoretically possible that your model has the right answer.
So yeah, if we have, you know, kind of like a cookbook, we put eggs and sugar and cream and all these things in, and we know we get this, and it looks like this, and we see in the satellite something that looks really similar, then we can know that that recipe at least has a pretty good chance of being the same thing.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and if you mix it all together and then your cake collapses, then maybe the temperature was different or the pressure in your oven was different. And that's exactly what people do with both analog models and numerical models.
Cool. Now, you've actually been doing some work specific to Mars. So what have you been doing that kind of expands our knowledge of Martian volcanoes?
Yeah, the volcanoes on Mars, there's a lot of them, and they're some of them are very, very big. And people care about them because there's this big question about whether Mars could have ever had life. You know, Mars is very similar to Earth in a lot of ways. And so people are curious about whether life could have evolved there, or, you know, maybe it started here because a meteorite carried it from Mars, things like that. So one of the questions that people have about Mars in general is was it habitable at some point? And volcanoes play into habitability a lot. They produce gases that can make atmospheres nice for living creatures. And they can melt ice to make water flow, which is also useful for most life as we know it. So knowing when and how long and what kind of volcanism was occurring on Mars is a big question that people have. What I have kind of contributed to that is I'm trying to figure out ways to use these remote sensing techniques since, you know, not only am I never going to Mars, probably nobody is ever going to go to the volcano parts of Mars because they're just too challenging and rugged for our technology. It's not very safe. The engineers are like, we want to put down our little rover in a very safe place. And we're like, but that's boring. So we're trying to figure out ways to use satellite data because satellites can take images of everything. They're really, really awesome. So satellite data on Mars is widely available, but we don't have a lot of good comparisons of what Earth would look like with those same kinds of satellite constraints. So I'm trying to figure out how the volcanoes in Idaho and in the very young volcanoes of Earth, how they look when you look at them as if you're looking at them from that satellite, so that now we have that comparison between Earth and Mars, and maybe we'll learn more about the Martian volcanoes because we know what happened with the Earth volcanoes.
Any kind of insights yet? Do Idaho volcanoes look very similar to Martian volcanoes so far?
Yeah, they do. Some of the Martian volcanoes look similar to the Idaho volcanoes. That's a complicated question.
Oh.
because it's really how deep do you dig? The things that we're finding is that we have a technique that we believe will be able to be reproducible on Mars using satellites that can tell us how many crystals are in the lava, which is really useful for a whole lot of reasons. And that's something that we currently can't do on Mars. We can't look at a volcano and say, oh, that one has 15% crystals, so it was super runny and it was really hot and it could have melted this much water. Or, oh, look, this one has 30% crystals, which means maybe it was erupting through kind of this icy layer, and that could tell us something about water on Mars. So there's a lot of questions that are kind of far removed from the literal work I'm doing. But you can't know how to interpret the crystallinity on Mars until you know if you can see the crystallinity on Mars. And so right now, we know we can see the crystallinity using these more remote techniques in Idaho. So we got to kind of narrow down some of the issues that Mars has that Idaho doesn't have, ironically. So Iceland is one of these places. I said Idaho, but we also are doing this study in Iceland. The most recent fieldwork we did was at Krafla in kind of north central Iceland. And it's this basaltic lava flow from kind of erupted in the 70s and the 80s. And it's very young, so we can see the surface really easily. It doesn't have a ton of lichen or moss or other life growing on it yet. And my graduate student has been looking at the satellite images of this flow in Iceland to figure out if we can see the crystal content from space, which is cool.
Nice. So a new volcano without all the stuff on top of it is helpful.
Yeah. Older volcanoes are complicated by factors of environmental interactions. And that's exactly why we care about volcanoes on Mars. We want to see those environmental interactions. But Earth is wet and messy and filled with gunk. Biological gunk. So Mars, right, we need to look at kind of the cleanest parts of Earth to really see what we see on Mars.
I mean, as I age, I become more complicated as well. So you're also doing some other work on Mars that has to do with microbes. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So Iceland in general is very good for looking at Mars comparisons because it's also Arctic. And the Arctic environment slows growth for most creatures. You can look at lava flows that are, you know, 5 years old, 10 years old, and they're pretty devoid of life. They're definitely devoid of plants and macro kind of life, but the microbial life is what we think probably started on Mars, right? Life probably started as the simplest, smallest little thing. So one of the studies that we're doing is, can we see changes in the rock from satellite data that might be due to very small microbial communities developing. And therefore, if we can we then use satellite data on Mars to target where it would be smartest to sample for actually finding evidence of those life forms? Because, yeah, imagine you have a whole planet and you have to find the, you know, one place where some microbial mat happened to grow. We're trying to find geologic ways to target those a little bit more economically.
Microbe in a haystack.
Yeah, big dust haystack.
So, changing topics a little bit, but not completely, you're also doing some work with NASA about when astronauts do get a chance to visit Mars. We're obviously going to want them to, you know, collect rocks and do all sorts of things, samplings, to figure out, you know, what's going on there. And they're going to have some problems that maybe aren't obvious to somebody who hasn't thought a lot about this. What are some of the problems they're going to encounter, and how are you helping them solve that?
Yeah, so this project is actually for the moon.
Oh!
Yeah, the Mars astronauts are going to have way more problems. So we're just starting with the moon first. Like, let's just figure out how to get people to pick up rocks in the right places on the moon. So we were talking a little bit about how challenging it is when you only have, you know, there's just not a lot of time. And so every single thing that they do on the surface is going to be really important that they, you know, there's not a lot of time to stand around and think about it and kind of, well, what about over here? Well, no, let's go over here. You need to have a really good plan to maximize the time that they have up there. You want to get them in, get them out, get the science, get done, make sure no one gets hurt, minimize the time that they're exposed to the really difficult environment on the moon. One of the studies that we're doing is how do you optimize picking up rocks in these challenging conditions that is the surface of the moon. And luckily we don't have to deal with low gravity or lack of oxygen. They're not making us do that. But what the NASA researcher folk are going to be making us do is navigate without the use of any kind of compass or GPS. They might even do a trial where we don't even have the sun, because on the moon, you're not going to have the same kind of circadian rhythm that our bodies are used to with the sun. So it's very disorienting for people on the surface of the moon. The light's all different. It's really extreme. You're in this big suit, which doesn't help. We're going to be trying to do our field work while they give us these sort of like battleship coordinate sheets, and we're going to call out numbers of where we think we are, and they're going to be seeing whether we're right or not. And it's going to be a bit of a show, I think. It'll be kind of funny to watch. So my new grad student gets to do that. Yay! Welcome to the University of Idaho. Here, try to do this thing and everyone's going to watch you.
And then that kind of leads us into our last topic that I wanted to talk about. People who do geology, they have to learn basic field skills, how to navigate, things like that. And you usually teach that in a field course during the summer. And over COVID, that kind of went up in the air. You can't put 10 people in a van and drive all over the place. What did you do to help students have this experience without putting them in a van?
Yeah, so that's a required course that students have to take to graduate. So we knew as soon as there were shutdowns that we were going to need to figure something out. I designed a course with the help of some of my colleagues to immerse the students in a geologic environment in a computer so that they could still walk around, look for rocks, and test their field skills in this kind of open platform, this sandbox type of video game. And the video game we chose was Minecraft because it's really very editable. You can kind of build your own world, you can make your own rocks, you can change the rules, and fly around and spy on the students, which is really convenient as a professor. Don't have to run to catch up to them across, you know, several mountains. You can just fly over there. It was really fun for the professors. I think the students had a pretty good time as well. But we did do some surveys to kind of gauge how engaged they were and how much they learned during that course too, because it was such a it's so different than what we had ever done before.
So were they able to learn the same things that they would have in the field course? Was it a success?
Yeah, so my humble opinion was that it was a great success. But we also did a study to see how much learning occurred. We did a pre and a post survey of the students and their knowledge before and after the course. And we also asked them a whole bunch of questions about, like, did you feel like you had a good experience? Did you feel like you learned things? Things like that. So we had both the quantitative data of how much they improved and the qualitative data of what their experience was. And overall, our study showed that students improved in their knowledge. They definitely learned things. The ones who really liked Minecraft before didn't learn any better than the ones who had really were kind of scared or apprehensive about using the technology. So the platform itself wasn't a barrier to anybody. And so people did a good job picking up the skills that we thought they could gain in the game. And then all the other little things that we knew we couldn't get in the game, we had figured out a bunch of activities that would target those things as well. And so far, I haven't had anybody from that very special year contact me and say, well, I have this geology job, but I just don't know how to do the fieldwork. Like, they've all gone off and been successful, and that's really the true measure.
You allowed me to fly around at one point in that class that year, and I gotta say, it was hilarious watching them, you know, all these little Spider-Mens, and, you know, they'd all picked their little outfits and stuff. And I seem to remember, like, you know, the little teacher one would be talking or whatever, and I feel like I even saw, like, somebody, like, hit each other with a cactus or push them into a cactus.
Yeah,
or...
you joined on a very early classroom day, and before we had realized how everyone was so excited to, like, be in the game, that they were like, oh, look what I can do. I can throw stuff, and I can dig, and I can bury you. And, they, you know, the people who knew how to use Minecraft were very savvy at messing around with the other people. And so the first sort of two, welcome to Minecraft, we're all in here and we're doing geology. We really had, it was like a elementary school classroom where you're like, everyone sit, stop moving. Jeez, just calm down. Focus on the rocks, people. I felt a little nervous at the time, but it worked out fine and everybody calmed down and they did their work. And it's part of it, right? It's like being in the field is fun and being in Minecraft is fun. So I think that really helped cement the similarities between the two experiences.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. It seemed like, because I came in a couple times throughout the course, and they seemed to get into it. They, you know, I'd track them around as they found their rocks, and yeah, they seemed to have a blast.
Yeah, they did.
All right. Well, we're getting on towards the end here a little bit. Any last thoughts that you want to leave with us, or any take-home messages about studying geology on other planets?
Yeah, people should do what they want with their lives. I mean, like, if you like the weirdest thing in the world and you also like video games, right, you can, like, combine those things now. There's so many opportunities to just follow what you want to do and make it work for what society needs or what people need. I think that's a cool part of my work that I've always been amazed by, that, like, I get to do the things I like that kind of don't necessarily need to help anybody, but I've found ways to make them somewhat useful, which is good.
Well, that's true. Kind of going back to the Minecraft thing just a little bit, I know in other conversations we've had that, yes, this was brought about by COVID, but you realized that there was probably other uses for a Minecraft geological classroom.
Yeah, that was one of the really good parts about, or a good outcome from COVID, is it raised so much awareness of how there's a big need for better accessibility in the geosciences and a lot of the field sciences. Are there ways that we can help people who might not be able to do exactly the same thing as everybody else still learn all these skills? And yeah, the Minecraft world, you can run around, fly around, jump around. You can do all of these things that can sometimes be limitations in the real world. So that's great.
All right. Well, Erica, thank you so much for coming on today.
You bet.
Danae, what did you think?
Well, it's very nice to hear that someone who is also afraid of volcanoes now loves volcanoes. Like, maybe that'll be me in another couple years. Who knows? At least I would be fascinated by them instead of being terrified of them. But I don't know. She talked about so many super interesting things But probably the number one, speaking of someone who is afraid of volcanoes, the fact that volcanoes can increase a planet's habitability, because in my mind, volcanoes are just destructive. Mm-hmm. They're just going to take out everything in their path if they erupt. But no, I mean, yes and.
Yes and. Volcanoes are very good at improv games.
Yes. Yeah. Like melting water, putting good gases into the atmosphere. That is just so cool. It did actually get me more on the side of volcanoes. They're not just big, scary things. They can also do good, interesting, cool stuff.
I think for me, the thing that stands out is just all the things that you have to think about in terms of planning to visit another planet. Like, I mean, I've read sci-fi books since I was a kid, but good, like the things you have to think about to be able to navigate. I never thought that that would be an issue. That never crossed my mind. It would be so exciting to have a job like that, where that's your job, to think of the problems that are gonna come up in these very harsh environments and how you can pre-solve those before you get there. Eric and I were talking a little off camera, and you know, she's talking about even how difficult it is for the astronauts to even lean over and pick up a rock. Those suits aren't terribly bendable. Half the time they fall over and can't get up when they're practicing.
Right. So they have to learn to bend and snap in a spacesuit.
Absolutely. Gotta learn the bend and snap. What a fabulous, imaginative way to spend your time thinking and solving these things.
Yeah, and speaking of imaginative, the things that came out of the COVID era when we all had to be separated, like, I'm very glad we don't have to do a lot of those things anymore, but just absolutely brilliant. Like, teaching your students how to do field work using Minecraft. That is so nuts and so brilliant, and I love it.
It was so fun to watch them bouncing around the mountains. They'd be, you know, running as fast as they can, and then you'd see all of them kind of stop. I couldn't hear them when they were talking because it was a different channel. And you'd see them all stop and, like, pull out their compasses. They had little compasses that you could see in their hand. And you'd see them turn and look around, and then they'd pick a different direction. And they'd all run in the other direction, and they'd finally stop. They had specially made rocks. Everything was kind of one color, sand or brown or whatever, until you'd get to their little special rock, and it was actually, like, it looked like marble or something unique. And then you'd see them running around, obviously measuring things and considering that they weren't allowed to go in the field. And that was the way it was. I mean, it looked like a blast.
Right. Yeah. I love that. I love it a lot.
All right. Well, thank you all for listening to The Vandal Theory. You can visit our website, uidaho.edu/vandaltheory, if you want to learn more about our research. We're on most of the podcasting platforms out there, so make sure that you rate and review us and absolutely subscribe. You can also email us at vandaltheory@uidaho.edu to contact us. I'm Lee Cooper.
And I'm Danae Lons.
Thanks for listening.